J.B. Van Hollen's public service began in the 1990s. He served as district attorney for Ashland and Bayfield counties. He then served as U.S. attorney for the Western District of Wisconsin. In 2006, he was elected attorney general. He will end 8 years as attorney general on January 8. Not a bad resume for a member of, how do you pronounce it? Ondasagan High School, class of 84?
That's a common mispronunciation. Ondasagan
High School.
Which no longer exists.
I know, it was folded in the 1990s.
They figured out if they were putting out product like me that, you know, they had no reason to exist anymore.
And their nickname, Aggies?
The Ondasagan Aggies.
What's an Aggie? Oh, anyway, can we talk about your 8 years? Congratulations on the 8 years that you'll end on January. It's quite a ride, wasn't it?
It was a great ride. You know, I'm very, very glad that I did it. I couldn't be more thankful that the Wisconsin gave me the honor of serving as their attorney general, trusted in me enough and what we did to let me come back and do it for four more years after the first four. There are a lot of reasons I hesitate to depart, but there's a time and a place for everything. I feel called to move on to other things, just as I felt called to become attorney general in the first place, and I'm looking forward to new opportunities.
Just on some issues, you devoted a lot more resources to catching internet sexual predators of children. What more, what else, what next steps should be done to protect children from these predators, General?
Well, a lot of it is still resources. You know, the interesting thing is when I first entered into office and I saw the raw numbers, 17,000 some known internet protocol addresses that had at least attempted to download known child pornography, and we were taking off maybe 100 a year. And when I realized that's almost like having a license plate number of the people who robbed the bank, yet you don't track down the license plate number even to find out who owns it. I could have come in and asked for a doubling of the resources of the Department of Justice just to protect our kids. But of course, being in politics, I knew that wasn't realistic. We took realistic steps to continue to move the program forward, to get law enforcement agencies throughout the state to join up, which we've done very successfully to broaden our approach, to make it more of a national issue, which I did as president of the National Association of Attorneys General. I had it as my issue for my year, my presidential initiative. There's a lot that we did to move the issue forward, but it's still touching the tip of the iceberg. You know, I really need General Elect Schimmel. We need General Elect Schimmel to make sure that this still is a focus and a priority, and I think he will because he's seen on the front lines the damage that this causes to child victims.
New subject, our on-again, off-again law, the photo ID law. Mm-hmm. Is there any doubt in your mind that there will be a photo ID requirement for the 2016 elections?
Yeah, no doubt in my mind whatsoever. As a matter of fact, we've won every case at every level, almost across the board. The only thing that could be looked at as a defeat that we've been dealt is when the Supreme Court basically said during the last election we couldn't have implemented because we were trying to do so too late. It was not in any way a ruling on the merits. I don't see any way that we're going to lose on the merits now if there's even another decision to be made.
Okay. Were you surprised at how the Court of Appeals and U.S. Supreme Court have overruled state laws and constitutional provisions against same-sex marriage? Should Wisconsin's constitutional prohibition be repealed?
Well, it has been. The constitutional provision is essentially repealed now.
Yes.
Same-sex marriages are permitted. I would not completely rule out the possibility that that could potentially change. Supreme Court declined to take the myriad of cases that were being appealed to them, including the one from Wisconsin. But one of the things the Supreme Court looks at is whether there's a split in jurisdictions. I think that at some juncture you may have a Court of Appeals that comes out and says, no, I think that prohibiting same-sex marriages is constitutional. The Supreme Court's going to be required to take the case then. And when they have to decide between the two, I think the you read too much into it if people say the declination to take the cases now is the court saying we don't think that the prohibitions are appropriate. So I don't think we've heard the last of the issue.
You know, do you think that it should be a state-by-state right to decide?
I do, and that's what we've argued for. Basically, the states have been overruled, finding that it's a violation of the United States Constitution. I think that's a broad ruling. I think it's a broad reading of the United States Constitution. By the same token, there are rulings that we're bound by in Wisconsin. As somebody who has said over and over again that I'm going to enforce the rule of law, that's what we're doing now. Our office, the governor's office, we're working together to make sure that same-sex partners have the ability to get married and have the same benefits as heterosexuals do now in the state of Wisconsin, because that is the state of the law, and it's our job to enforce that law.
Are we making progress in the war on heroin and the growing?
We're definitely making progress.
Significant?
I think significant. Significant enough? Absolutely not. It's a huge problem, and it's a double front. It's a war on heroin, and it's a war on prescription drug abuse. And we are making more progress on the prescription drug abuse front, which is causing more problems in the heroin front. But long term, I think we're making progress on the next generation of users. By preventing prescription drug abusers today, we're preventing heroin abusers of tomorrow. So I think we have made a lot more progress that we haven't seen yet. We're educating the general public in both categories in ways we never have. We've made legislative changes that I think are going to have a big impact. Law enforcement is more aware of the problem. People are more aware of the problem. I think we are making great progress, but heroin is certainly the biggest problem that's faced us in a long time. It's going to take a lot more effort going forward, and I know General-elect Schimmel has it as his number one priority, and I think he should.
We can't lock our way out of that problem. In other words, we can't fill the prisons and jails to fix that problem. Correct, General?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think we can fill the prisons or jails to fix any problem. Closest we can come to that would be with child sexual assault, because most pedophiles are proven that they have clinical problems that can't be cured, and we have to lock people up to protect our kids. By the same token, we can also educate the general public, educate our kids, educate the parents to make victims less available to these pedophiles. So I don't think even in that category we can lock up people and throw away the key, which is why we've worked on reforms and alternatives to incarceration. It's something that the governor's office and my office have been working on very diligently for the last couple of years. It's where, if you look at what the Department of Justice has done on heroin, primarily what we've been doing is trying to change legislation and educate the public, because there are other areas where we can have a greater impact.
DNA testing, that's going to be expanded. That's mm-hmm. the current law. Do lawmakers who voted to expand DNA testing know how much that's going to cost, and do you think they'll fund it in the next budget cycle, sir?
They do, and I think they will, yes. They know how much it costs as far as dollars that come out of the state budget up front, because we've given good fiscal estimates on that. But they also know how much it would cost if they didn't do it, how much it would cost law enforcement by not getting resolution to many cases they'd get resolution to, how much it would cost local law enforcement to have to continue to go out there and investigate cases they may not have to investigate otherwise, and how much it would cost society if we have people continuing to be victimized who maybe we could prevent the crimes from occurring if we get these serial offenders, especially, off the streets sooner. So I think they're aware that ultimately it's a savings. And I think we have to look at that bigger picture. And I'm very pleased that we've been able to make that argument over the last 8 years on a number of issues. And succeed in that regard, that the immediate dollars we spend save money in the long term. Let's look beyond just this budget.
Well, but as we expand DNA testing, are you satisfied that safeguards are in the new law, that people who are tested later found to be not convicted or charged dismissed? Is their DNA going to be protected?
Absolutely. I have every comfort in the world that is going to be occurring. One of the reasons why I supported this legislation is because the governor's office agreed to let basically my office draft it. So we had all these protections, so we knew that it was workable, that it was legal, that it was fiscally responsible, that we had time to train law enforcement to better do the job, so that we had the implementation in place where we didn't have DNA samples fall through the cracks and end up having problems. And so we put a lot of effort into it. It hasn't rolled out yet, and that's because we wanted to make sure we had the time to roll it out correctly. So I'm very comfortable that it's going to work.
Do you think most people know that the DNA, the number of DNA samples is going to be expanded, that some cases they haven't had their DNA sample, but mm-hmm. they will in the future?
You know, I think a lot of people know. I don't know what necessarily common citizenry know. I think fortunately for us, or maybe unfortunately, depending upon how you look at it, the people who are most informed, the people who pay attention to the media, the people who would be aware that this is occurring, are the people who are never going to have to worry about it. They're not going to get arrested for anything. So perhaps it may be a surprise to some people who have been arrested numerous times and suddenly are arrested and have to give a DNA sample. Maybe it'll be a wake-up call. I hope so.
I've been intrigued by the New York Times stories. The Attorney General in the state of Oklahoma has organized GOP attorneys generals to form at least two groups to fight what they say is the Obama administration's abuse of powers overreach in areas like environmental protections, healthcare, and immigration. What do you think is the most serious example of the Obama administration's overreach? Is it this recent case that you just joined, immigration?
Boy, I think it's a tough call. I think the methodology that the president has used in immigration and the methodology he used in the health care law, Obamacare, are both very good examples. The best example, perhaps, Obamacare, because we've already had the Supreme Court agree with us that he overreached. You know, people think that we lost that case because Obamacare still exists. Mm-hmm. I said repeatedly, perhaps in front of you, that my goal was never to overthrow Obamacare. My goal was to make sure that we protect the rights of the states to govern and that we make sure we hold the President and Congress accountable for overstepping their lawful and constitutional bounds, and we did so. The Supreme Court ruled in our favor on almost every issue we argued. They just found that those issues were severable and Obamacare could stand alone even though several provisions in it were unconstitutional. So we've had the United States Supreme Court rule that the President has overstepped his bounds. And we have shown the importance of the attorneys general banding together to fight against this sort of overreach. Immigration is another example where we felt the need to do so. The president has done something that we believe, a number of us, 24 states now, is clearly in violation of his lawful authority. We need to make sure that we hold him accountable. If we don't, who's going to?
What about the president's argument that he has to act through executive order because Congress is so dysfunctional, it can't act on some of these major issues, sir?
You know, it's basically the president saying that he's smarter than everybody else, and therefore, since this is important enough to get done, that he's going to violate the law to do it. That's dangerous.
About 1 in 20 adults now have CCW, mm-hmm. concealed weapon permits. Are you surprised that there's been so few major incidents involving those weapons and adults with permits?
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all. Matter of fact, during the argument or debate about concealed carry, probably from the time I first ran for office, I argued that there weren't going to be problems. Putting firearms lawfully in the hands of law-abiding citizens does not make our society more dangerous. There's been very little, if any, evidence that it does. Basically, it was prohibiting law-abiding citizens from carrying concealed weapons was a solution in search of a problem. I think every state proved that before Wisconsin had the chance to do so, and we're proving it now.
So our citizens and homes are safer as a result of our CCW law?
You know, there's not a lot of evidence that they're safer. They may be. It may be a general deterrence. It may be there's some specific instances that we can point out. For me, it wasn't necessarily an argument that it increased public safety. It was an argument that United States citizens, Wisconsin citizens, have a constitutional right that they were being deprived for no public safety reason. And the fact that there are no instances that we have of bad conduct because we can carry concealed weapons is proof that the government should stay out of our lives where they don't show a compelling reason to be involved.
Some lawmakers want to do with the Government Accountability Board. They want to rework it and reform it, they say. There's been some discussion of another partisan board. Your DOJ has represented GAB. Do you think it's been an effective enforcer of campaign laws and ethics laws? Is it broken? Does it need to be fixed?
Well, I think the whole system needs to be fixed, and it's been proven by some of the court decisions that we've had, and I think some of the court decisions that we're going to have again soon. Campaign finance law is broken. It's full of loopholes. There are problems with it. GAB has been trying to enforce antiquated laws. I think our legislature and our governor are going to have to look at passing new legislation to reform everything. In the process, they may find, as the laws change, that the need for GAB in its current format changes as well, and I think many of them already hold that viewpoint. So I certainly think it's something that they need to address at a grander level. We have represented GAB, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully. If you recall, early in my administration, we sued the GAB. There definitely are a lot of issues that surround it that have led to a lot of litigation, and I don't think it's unwise for the legislature to explore changes.
What grade do you generally give these six former judges who have been serving on GAB?
You know, I haven't individually really paid any attention to what those judges have done or are doing, and I'm in no position to give them a grade.
I did an interview with State Representative Dave Craig, who's listening to ideas to rewrite the John Doe laws. Do you think local prosecutors have abused the John Doe laws? Is that system broken and need to be fixed?
I think it warrants looking at. The biggest problem I see with John Doe laws is the reason they're called John Doe is because they're supposed to be anonymous. I've been very careful since the day I started in office, my first office, not just this one, of making sure that we don't talk about the existence or non-existence of investigations, we don't confirm or deny, because it's very important for people to be considered guilty by virtue of being accused. For how many years now, Governor Walker and others, mostly Governor Walker, have had a pail, a cloud hanging over their head of being having done something wrong by virtue of the fact that everybody knows there's been John Doe investigations going on. That's wrong. No matter how you slice it, that is wrong. And it's a pail that you can never get rid of. Early on in my administration, I cleared Governor Doyle on several investigations that had been made clear the DOJ was looking into him for, found that they were completely meritless. Republicans could get angry that I gave him clearance, but the bottom line is people assumed he had done things wrong by virtue of the fact that the public had been made aware of the fact that he was being investigated. When I found that not only was he really almost not being investigated, but there was no basis for it, I thought it really important to come out and clear the air. None of that should have ever occurred. And I think that is a problem with our John Does that certainly needs to be addressed.
When you say none of that should have come out, are you talking to things that, like the prosecutors want to refer to as the governor's being investigated as part of a criminal scheme, that type of disclosure?
Well, anything. There's whether it be Governor Doyle or whether it be Governor Walker, the public should not be aware of the fact that they're being investigated any more than anyone else, because the fact that they're being investigated doesn't mean that there's any smoke, not to mention fire. Yet the press makes it look like there's fire, and the general public then frequently believes that there's fire. That's not fair to the governors of either party any more than it is to an ordinary citizen.
Let's talk about public service and politics. If you give the commencement address to next spring's UW-Madison Law School class of 2015, mm-hmm. What are you going to tell them? What potential warnings, what advice are you going to give them about a career in public service and politics?
You know, I would tell them that I've spent most of my career in public service and politics tangentially or directly involved in that, and that it's very satisfying, and that to a degree that it's important for everybody, if they feel at all called, to serve part of their career in public service, not just because it's an ability to give back to others who perhaps are less fortunate and could deserve your aid and assistance, but because in my experience, having been U.S. Attorney, having been AG, and in other capacities, I've gotten to work with people and be one of the people who comes to work every day and say, you know what, I represent the United States of America, or I represent the state of Wisconsin. That's pretty heady stuff. And I found that public servants take it very seriously and are very proud of that opportunity. And not everybody has the opportunity to bear arms for our nation's defense. But many people have the opportunity to do other things that really protect our citizens in other ways, where your life's not as much at risk, but that are just as important as bearing arms. And so to have the opportunity to do that for your state and your country or your municipality are really great opportunities that I would encourage everybody to at least give a try to.
What toll does it take on the public official and her or his family?
Well, it takes a toll in a couple of ways. Obviously, for many positions anyway, it's a financial hit to serve in public office. Not asking anybody to, you know, obviously do any fundraising for my personal family. We did well, and, you know, obviously we pay living wages or beyond, but compared to what you could make in the general market, generally for a lawyer especially, it's a financial hit. But it can be something that you have to have an awful lot of thick skin to do, especially in elected office. Every day expect to be accused of doing things that you didn't do. Once in a while you get credit for things you didn't do as well. it can be tough. It can be tough to get up in the morning and read the newspaper or have your kids read the newspaper that says your dad did this and here's why he did it, and it makes it look like he's a bad guy, when you can read the paper and say, well, I didn't even do that, or that's certainly not why I did it. But what's printed in the paper becomes the gospel truth to many people. Because they don't have the opportunity to get the other side of the story or to hear the truth.
You've been in public service since the early 1990s. You're not yet 50. Are you done with partisan politics?
You know, I don't know if I am or not. I think it would be foolish to foreclose that. You never know what the good Lord's going to call you to do next. I can say in the very short term that I'm going to move on to other things. You know, I'm anxious to try something different. I don't think it's unwise for people to take a break from public service once in a while. And that's what I intend to do, at least for the short term.
Did you consider running for the Supreme Court in April?
I thought about it. I thought about a number of different opportunities in elective office and non-elective office over the course of the last several years. Just don't think, with my family being the age they are and the situation I'm in life, that it's necessarily the right thing for me to be doing right now.
What are you going to do next? Private practice?
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to
step away from the public service?
Yeah, I'm going to be in the private sector in some capacity. I'll wait till I get out of office to firm up exactly what that is.
Are you going to play a role as the presidential campaign shape up in 2016?
I may or may not. It depends upon who the candidates are, who the legitimate candidates are, as different caucuses and primaries play out, and quite frankly, whether any candidates who I believe in think I'm of any value to them.
Any unfinished business as you leave office, General?
There's always unfinished business. Obviously, if you think you've wrapped everything up, then nobody needs to come in and take over. I'm very pleased that most of the major litigation that we've had, whether it be voter ID or Act 10 or redistricting, really is resolved for the most part, and we've been very successful. But maintaining a crime lab where we get information back to local law enforcement in a timely manner is an ongoing battle. And getting rid of the backlog is part of the problem. Making sure it doesn't come back, especially as our roles expand, is something that my successor, is going to have to focus on significantly. Continuing to increase our fight against pedophiles is going to be a big issue. Heroin's a big issue. In this day and age, when people expect, or many people think, that an AG should be political, I wish Brad the best in making sure that he keeps partisanship out of the office and make sure the rule of law prevails. And that's always a difficult task as well, I wish I could have left office with everybody understanding, yep, there's no place for partisanship and nobody arguing for it, but there's still some out there who think the AG should be a mini governor, and that's always a battle that is going to take place.
Congratulations on two terms. Do you want to sing the Ondasigan fight song?
I don't even know what it is.
Very good.
Maybe we didn't have one.
You Aggies, you probably have them. General, thanks a lot for your time, and good luck, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it. God
Thank
bless.
You. Thank you.